to Queens of the Bees. I am your podcast co-host, Mark Muster, a licentious little Leo, I guess would be a good way to put it.
And I'm your other co-host, TJ. Nowadays, I'm a gardener extraordinaire. I'm doing some backyard gardening. So
plant daddy.
Plant daddy and the happy little homemaker these days. So that's me.
Yeah.
And thank you for joining us, as always. We love our listeners very much. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, this is my intro. Will you please stop talking?
Anyway, you weren't saying anything, so I felt like I had to fill the silence.
Well, it's called a pregnant pause, TJ. It's to give people time to get ready for the drama, you know? Anyway, today we are talking about a great film called Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I actually watched this film pretty recently in my, long queer career, and I like it.
Yeah,
and since it was my idea, excuse me. So TJ, since this was my idea, you are going to give us a 15 words or less summary of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Okay, so two drag queens and a trans woman go into the Australian outback. Adventures ensue.
That was 11. Maybe 16.
And father and son bond there.
You didn't even use road trip in there.
Well, I said to go on trip to the outback.
No, it's a road trip through the outback.
Whatever.
I mean, drag queens on a road trip. That's like the gimmick. It's great.
It's drag queens and a trans woman. I feel like we
drag
should
drag queens and a trans woman. Excuse me. Sorry.
She
is known as a.
She is a performer.
As a drag queen from the past. Yeah.
Right.
Whose gender identity is trans. But we'll get into it. Your summary was adequate. I would have said Guy Pearce, Lord Elrond, and a trans woman go on a road trip through the outback.
You weren't giving the summary. I was. Therefore, I feel like I captured. I captured pretty eloquently the gist of the narrative.
Okay. Well, I'm done with you. Let's get into it, TJ.
I feel like that's better than most of the summaries that you provide, but that's neither here nor there.
I'm stopping recording now.
Okay, so now we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the film, since, you know, the big part of this podcast is where we discuss things. So there's a lot to talk about in this movie, and so we'll just dive right in. So Mark chose the film, I'm going to take the initiative in talking about it, and then he can mm-hmm. chime in as we go. So one of the things
just
that
strikes
me, yeah. Yes, you're
your
not,
show.
You're never reticent about diving in, so or interrupting me rudely. but one of the things that really stood out to me about this movie is just how much it is a profoundly moving movie. In ways mm-hmm. that I didn't expect. I mean, I'd seen it before, but how much my perspective has changed, which we'll get to in the deep cuts. But, you know, I know the movie is supposedly about Hugo Weaving's character Tick and his vexed relationship with his wife and his son, who he hasn't seen in several years. Mm-hmm. But what struck me is just how much humanity and warmth and empathy is in the character Bernadette, who's played by Terrence Stamp, of all people. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot to unpack about this bit of casting. And it's one of the things that I, when I went in watching the movie, I thought it would not age particularly well because, you know, it is a cisgender straight man playing the only actual trans woman of the three main characters.
Right.
But what amazed me is how much he puts into this role and how well he captures the fundamental sort of humanity of this trans woman who's trans in a time, you know, remember, like, Bernadette is what, in her 50s, maybe 60s, I think, like diegetically speaking. So, you know, this is a trans woman who has come of age, transitioned probably rather late in life, mm-hmm. Given all things. And so, you know, she's not had an easy time of it, but there are so many small glimpses that we get. The moment when he's, you know, when Bernadette is talking about to Tick about, you know, his childhood and how. Mm-hmm. She's very sad that she didn't get to tell her parents how happy her childhood was because they didn't speak to her after she had confirmation surgery. And so, you know, it would have been easy, I think, for someone of Stamps, he's a prestigious actor, but it would have been easy. This is the early 90s, so it would have been very easy to make this role a stereotype. But I was just really stunned by how, like, rich and warm Bernadette is as a character, and who has every right to be bitter and angry, but is, in fact, very comfortable in her own skin, and mm-hmm. how Stamp is comfortable in this role. Like, I found that he really immersed himself into her person in mm-hmm. a way that I had not expected, thinking about it in the years since I've seen it, and, you know, the way we think about trans stuff. I was just really struck by how much this movie is driven by Bernadette so much more than I remembered it being.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, like, the film does a good job, besides the casting, of kind of giving Bernadette... Well, she's the most interesting character, I think.
Yes, by far.
Has the best arc, too. And she has mad respect, to use the youngins' terms, which is, like, kind of vaguely gestured at. Mm-hmm. That she was, like, an amazing performer, so much so that now she's almost, like, coming out of retirement, basically, to do this. And which, for the listeners, these three drag queens get a kind of a tour gig where they get to go around the Outback and they rent, like, an RV and just, like, drive around. And Bernadette's arc, she finds love, kind of transitions careers, really, in our life, or life changing near the end of the film. It's quite a snapshot for its time that has a lot kind of dolled up into it. I'm not really making any sense, but it's interesting to see, like, she's maybe this is what you're talking about with his ability to kind of come into the role. Like, she seems like such a queer elder just from the get-go, the way her mannerisms, her atmosphere, her aesthetic, and even, like, the comedy that she exhibits isn't making fun of her, right? It's actually her kind of embracing herself and using that, and that's what I really like, right? It's very easy to become the gimmick, but she decides not to do that.
It would have been so easy to make this character a stereotype. Like, it would mm-hmm. have made it, and it would have been equally easy to make her the butt of jokes.
Right.
But she's, as you rightly point out, she is not. And so she sort of bends the narrative around herself in ways that I don't necessarily think the film intended it. Because, I mean, the film is ostensibly about Tick going to this casino run by his ex-wife or his estranged wife to meet their son. Like, that's the whole gist of it, is that that's why they set out on this journey. And it's supposedly about him, Tick struggling with whether he wants to come out to his son and as a drag queen and all this other stuff. But somehow it really becomes more about Bernadette and, you know, her trying to find happiness. Because when the film begins, she's just lost her young lover, mm-hmm. Who's like 25, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, sexy with him,
25.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just was like, I just loved that it made her a character with sex interests. Like, I mean, that's pretty radical. Like, we, even, you know, with all the strides that trans people have made in representation, it strikes me that sometimes it's hard to see them as sexual beings. Like, if that makes sense, there's a certain discomfort with, I mean, there's discomfort with sort of marginalized genders and sexualities in cinema anyway. Like, there's just an ambivalence about showing gay sex or queer sex in any of its forms. But, mm-hmm. you know, it makes it quite clear that she still is someone who feels physical desire. And I think that that's really quite extraordinary. And to Stamp's credit, that he was able to capture this element of her persona.
Yeah, and I think it also, it adds, maybe what we're kind of getting at too, is it does a good job of portraying, sometimes I think we get lost or upset, like the obsession of the camera or the story is about coming out, like aspects of queer life, right? If it's a trans narrative, it's about being trans, like, and mm-hmm. what, how much of obsession can we do about that? But in fact, in actuality, people are trans and they look for love as well, right? Which involves sex. Mm-hmm. And so Bernadette's character arc is an encapsulation of all of those things, right? She's actually fine with her transness. We don't really get that narrative. What we more get is a trans person looking for love, or mm-hmm. well, grieving a love and then looking for another one.
Mm-hmm. And finding it in very unexpected places.
Is it coded that he dies of AIDS? I forget. Or is it not?
I think it's no. I mean, yeah, maybe a little bit. It's
this is 90s. I just don't remember.
I think that's implied. I think that that's one I think it's a reasonable inference that you could make.
Well, I'm making it. I'm inferring.
I mean, because it is, I mean, AIDS does bubble up to the surface occasionally elsewhere, like when the van is paint is, you know, graffitied with, go back, go home, AIDS fuckers or whatever. I don't know. Something equally crass and disgusting and cheap. But, you know, I just, I like the way this film really sort of allows Bernadette to just be a human. And I don't mean that in sort of like banal way that people are always like, it's just a human story, blah, 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 blah. But I do mean that in the sense that it doesn't like fetishize her transness, which it could easily have done, but instead allows us to see her as a, just a human being who is trans. Like it's, it doesn't shy away from her transness, but as you said, like it doesn't make, that's not the point of her arc, is not, I mean, it's, she's already very comfortable with who she is and who she has been.
Yeah, it's very sweet.
And I like that. I really do. Yeah. I was really blown away by how much I appreciated her character. Yeah.
And we watch her getting courted, which is like kind of nice, right? It's, I mean, very sweet. It's, them by the fire.
Right. I mean, sweet. In some ways, she gets less flack than the other two. Because
flack like in general, like from
the world. I mean, except for the one person who like acts like an asshole when they first pull in and is like, we didn't like your type around there. But... You know, and then Bernadette's like, you know, get the fuck out of my face. And then they end up having a drinking contest, which Bernadette wins. So,
that's,
I don't know.
So
I
just, funny.
I know.
Was it with a lesbian? I forget.
Well, I don't know. Is the woman a lesbian? I mean, she's just really butch. Okay. She's butch, just really butch. And as a great.
But in that way, it's like the film is kind of like, we're watching a moment of like exclusionary like competition, but in fact, it's like queers on queers kind of, which is very interesting.
Right. Someone else who's non-gender normative, shall we say.
Yes. I should say that. Yes. Correct. But I find that quite delightful, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very in the aesthetic of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, I feel that, you know, we're touching controversy, but we're really kind of just still having fun with it. We're not like, that's Tick's narrative too. Tick's internalized homophobia from being a drag queen, not really accepting themselves, and then kind of, I think it's actually projecting that onto the estranged wife and the kid, because when we finally meet them, we find that they're actually quite accepting, and the whole narrative is not what we thought it was to begin with.
Yep.
But at the same time, and like that's kind of the queer joy of the film, right? Is that like it's never really those themes of what we assume, it's like our assumptions of homophobia that we put onto the world in the films are always kind of undone, in very clever ways and sometimes very funny ways.
Yeah, and I like that idea about the undoing, like about it's a utopian film, and I mean that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't want to project like American geographic like difference onto Australia because they're very different cultures, but I suspect that as with the U.S. that, you know, in the big cities like Sydney and such, which Bernadette makes this point, like they thought the city was a prison, but in fact it's their shelter from the harshness of the outside world, and they've like queers have obviously collected and coagulated in cities because that's where they can find community and can erect their sort of sanctuary against their more dangerous world outside. But I do think that, you know, at least is in the Australia that this film creates, that, you know, there's an expectation that they're going to run into negativity in the hinterlands, as it were, which they do, but the unexpected part is that they find islands of warmth and compassion where you wouldn't necessarily expect it, whether that's in, you know, with a moment where everyone at the bar where, you know, Bernadette wins the drinking contest and it just sort of accepting them for who they are. You know, they don't make a big deal out of it, or whether it's Bob sort of embracing Bernadette and finding physical attraction to her. There's all these sort of unexpected moments that I don't necessarily get true life. Like I don't think that films like, you know, the American version of this, like Tu Wong Fu, I'm not quite that sanguine about small town life, but I think that these films are nice for that, for those of us who do come from small towns, who wish perhaps that small town life was a little more accepting and a little bit less belligerent and antagonistic than it ends up being.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Priscilla's ever imagining that it's a truthful film.
No, of course. Yeah. Exactly. It's very much aware of what it's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
But I also, I mean, like, I do think that, you know, Tick's narrative, although I personally find it less interesting, because I don't think, I mean, I think that Hugo Weaving does a fantastic job in this role. And I mean, it's hard from 2021 to not see him as either Elrond of Lord of the Rings or Agent Smith of The Matrix, because those are what his most widely known roles are. But I do think that he captures, like, this sort of, this young man, although he never seems to age, like, he looks the same now as he's looked then, which is weird in itself, but he does capture
he's really Lord Elrond.
Yes, exactly. But he manages to capture the sort of a person struggling with their identity, and I think that captures a lot of the complexity that queer people, particularly of that age and in that area, may have had, where, you know, yes, he happened to, you know, whether he fell in love or just had a fling with what is it, Marion is her name? You know, yeah. Whether...
Well, they were childhood friends, I think, right? And then they get married.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, I think that that's, again, a really important part of a lot of people's queer experience that is not always as common, I think, today as it was. Now that, of course, it's much easier to, in some degrees, to be queer than it was in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, yeah, his narrative is pretty... boring to me, but
it is. I agree. Up until we actually meet Marion and the child and the kid, I'm just kind of like, well, he's fine. Like, I'm much more interested in Bernadette. But when they actually meet them, I was like, okay, this is they inject a needed element into this movie, for because Marion is just so damn charismatic, and I love the character. And I, you know, we were pre-gaming, and I mentioned, like, it's like this moment when Tick actually sees what's the kid's name, the boy's name. It's not important at the moment.
It's not important.
Sees him, like, playing near the water, and then the kid's like, do you have a boyfriend? And it's...
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, will you perform... The really part that, like, sort of punched me in the feels was, like, will you perform ABBA for me? And I was just like... There's just such innocence about it. And just, he's just so... You know, he just has been raised to see his father... as being, you know, and seeing queerness in all its forms as just being so natural. Mm-hmm. Like, again, it's utopian, but that's what I love about it, is that, you know, kids learn how to be bigots. It's not intrinsic to human nature. Like, right. You can raise kids to be perfectly accepting of queer identity. And I think that's really quite radical even now. And I just love that it's a beautiful moment and very touching.
I mean, queers have always had to sometimes imagine their futures, right, that are not necessarily real, thinking of certain scholars, which I quite like. And this film definitely does it. I mean, in the end, it basically performs a queer family unit, right? The son is going to come on tour with them.
Mm-hmm. And he goes back to Sydney.
Sorry?
He goes back to Sydney.
He goes back to Sydney with them. And I think the idea is that he's going to grow up in drag culture.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely acceptable and okay. Right. Which is interesting because they seem to not have a lot of money. So yeah. I don't really know how raising a child is going to go well. But like we said, it's utopian. I'm so happy to to support that. And of course, the new family unit is Bernadette, the matriarch, is now gone. Right. She's moved on to bigger and better things. And with a couple, she's coupled now. And the new queer family is... I forget that the mom goes. No, she stays behind, right?
Yeah, she stays because she's only sending him to Sydney to get a break. Like, she just needs a break from racing.
So yeah, Agent Smith and the son, and then Felicia, Guy Pearce go back. And Guy Pearce is very interestingly like a babysitter kind of, because his character is very immature anyway. So they kind of are like babysitter / friend brother kind of vibe. And we get to enjoy that and see that go off and be kind of in the future in the world and things like that.
Right.
Which is nice.
Yeah. So I like that it shows, I like that you refer to Bernadette as the matriarch, because it's clear that she has sort of taken both Tick and, Guy Pearce's character, whose name, is Adam / Felicia.
Yeah. They call her Felicia.
under her wing, and sort of help them to navigate the world of queer life. And I mean, I think that's something that, you know, we may be a little bit in risk of at that dynamic being lost. I mean,
what, gay elders?
Yeah. Or at least not as much because of an altitude of, you know, the closing of gay bars and such, which were places where that typically took place. Mm-hmm. And of course, COVID has exacerbated that problem even more. So I think it's really, in that way, I think that this movie is sort of like a time capsule of an earlier moment of gay life. And as you said, like, AIDS hovers off the edge of the screen. Like, it's, you know, it's never far from the imagination, even if it's not really explicitly raised diegetically. But, I mean, this is released in the early 90s, so, you know, it can't but be there. It's 94, so, you know, it can't but be present, even if it's not really explicitly verbalized or made visible.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we could have a... We talk about gay elders a lot on this podcast. Maybe we should have our own.
Yeah, we should have an episode about gay elders. I mean, because it's important. Because, I mean, yes, queer people are more accepted now, but that's why, like, why we make a point on this pod of including earlier movies, because they're at risk of falling through the cracks and, you know, in the rush for the new. But these are parts of queer experience and parts of, you know, movies like Priscilla were sort of inductions for queer people.
Well, what's even more interesting, I think, too, is that in some ways, when the narrative comes to a close, right, when everybody's conflict is solved, Tick realizes that it's okay who he is and can take his son and whatever, is when Bernadette, the gay elder and matriarch, steps out of the picture, right?
Yeah.
Like, as though, like, her job has finished.
Mm-hmm.
And now she can enjoy life for herself.
On her own terms, right? Yeah.
Yes. Which is very, very interesting because we never see... It's not that she's ever stressed by being the matriarch. It's more that, like... So it's not, like, a reward situation. It's more just, like, a... It's almost like she is giving this to somebody, and now she's just like, I'm doing this for me, right? Mm-hmm. And she even kind of says that, right? Like, I'm doing this for me. And everybody kind of gets to be happy at the end. It's like a happy ending for everybody. But that's, I think, very interesting that, like, in some ways we could even talk about being the gay elder as, like, the full responsibilities on the youths. Like, your happiness is not... Either you have it or you don't have it. You know, it's like, it's like not as important.
Yeah.
And then this narrative, it was actually the end of that, of being the matriarch, actually coincided with the beginning of a life of love, or a next chapter of love, which is kind of nice.
Mm-hmm. And I like that the love between Bob and Bernadette is just so organic. Like, you don't get the feeling that Bob is fetishizing her or any of the other things that you might expect of someone sort of falling in love with of ostensibly a straight man falling in love with a trans woman. Like, I like the sensitivity and the sort of nonchalant is the word I would use. Like, it's not, it doesn't make a spectacle of itself. Like, he buys her roses before they perform at the casino. Like, I don't know, it's very touching and very warm and understated in a way that I think makes it very effective.
It can sometimes be a little too touching, I think.
Well, you're much more of a cynic than I am.
Yeah, this is true. This is true.
I'm a sucker for a good romance. Mm-hmm.
But
also, real quick, I feel like we would be remiss if we did not talk that Bernadette has some of the best costuming. And I don't mean the drag costumes. I mean just her everyday wear. Like, that's part of the reason, to refer to what I was earlier saying, is that Terrence Stamp just is so comfortable in the clothing. Like, I think that that's so much of what makes Bernadette feel authentic and real as a character, is how naturally she wears women's clothing. I mean, not as a costume, but just as her everyday attire. Like, I think that's a really powerful part. And I just love, like, the white flowing, like, outfits. I just love it. I was like,
yeah.
I was like, that's what I want to wear.
Yeah, it truly looks comfy. Yeah.
It does, doesn't it?
When she walks off, when they're stranded in the desert and she kind of walks away for a bit to, like, go exploring or, like, searching or whatever.
Yep.
The outfit she wears is great.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the ones I was thinking of. Or the one where she's standing outside the casino and when she says she's going to stay. Yeah. Like, she's wearing that, you know,
it's blue.
I think so. And it's just like, God, she was so good. I mean, whoever did the costuming for this was brilliant.
Superb. I mean, they had to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we talk about Guy Pearce?
Yes, we can. So why don't you start? So I have
you a have
different
thoughts?
No, I have a different relationship to you have more like thoughtful commentary on this character than I do.
Which is funny because to me, like, I don't know if Guy Pearce's character, Felicia, really deserves this much thought, but I just I need to speak about it. I just can't.
Speak your truth, Marcus.
Yeah, thank you for the support. I just, this recent time that I watched it, I was thinking about, you know, TJ and I have been talking about the not so, I would say not so recent phenomena of like himboism in gay culture. And you know, we're talking about how most of the characters are not very stereotyped, or the stereotype is kind of turned on its head, but Felicia is that stereotype to a T, and I think in a really bad way. I mean, so Guy Pearce is hot, you know, like classic, so the classic himbos you're all thinking of right now, listeners, like sexy, white, promiscuous, and I might also mention, and this is very important, rich. So Felicia has money from their family, and they actually buy the car that they travel around in. So, like, the kind of unconcerned with economic disparity, basically like a spoiled brat that just, like, can do whatever they want. And the problem, though, is that the film makes them out to be that spoiled brat to the point where they are stopping in a small town, and Felicia goes, like, does it, like, she's basically addicted to drugs and does some drugs by herself and goes to basically try to hook up with some dudes or kind of some minors or whatever. They're minors?
Yeah.
Oh,
they're the mining town.
You mean my mine, not less than 17. I was like, no, those are older.
I meant minors.
She goes to seduce some minors. Yeah. And it ends up that they chase her around, and she kind of, it has the threat of like, there's a threat that she's going to get murdered, but she's also kind of laughing and having a good time. So my problem with that is that, the film makes out her promiscuity, her drugs, like the way that she is being very stereotypically, I might say, white and gay, into a kind of, oh, you're asking to get like basically raped and murdered. And hate I crimes, don't think
what I would say.
Hey, crimed, yeah. And I mean, they basically say what they're gonna do to her. And I don't think that is the best way to portray this character, especially because I think that on the surface, Guy Pearce is like, I think that Himbo should take a look at what Guy Pearce's aesthetic is and notice the similarities and see. I think sometimes we're praising the wrong things about that in our culture and our community. And I think Guy Pearce is a good example of like what maybe we should be looking at a little bit deeper. Because I think that like those connections are very easily made. The film makes those connections very easily. And like we might be in fear of making those connections as well. And we should really be reflecting just a bit, just a tiny bit.
No,
also,
I agree.
Also, he's hot.
He is hot. I mean, what always strikes me when I watch this movie, in particular about Felicia, is A, how hot she is. But it's, yeah, and I don't disagree with you that, like, I'm a little squeamish about the way in which it seems like she deserves what's coming to her, which she doesn't really.
Right.
I think it's making the point of, like,
but it doesn't investigate like why she behaves this way, and like maybe she is there. I think the point is that like I think there are bad behaviors that she exhibits that need to be talked about. I think the film doesn't talk about them. Right. They basically are just like, well, you're gonna get hate crimes.
Yeah, I think of the three characters, she has the least development, and there are there's just faint allusions to her,
and she kind of gets away with it too. It makes me pissed off.
I mean, because you know, as you say, there's the allusion to her rich family. She persuades her mother to give her money so that she can, or you know, or should say he. Felicia like slash Guy Pearce says something to the effect of like, you know, mommy, maybe if I go on this trip I'll be able to turn straight, like, so you know, you get allusions to the trouble, like clearly that Felicia has a troubled upbringing, but not enough to make them a really sympathetic or well-rounded character, in fact that they just come across as being incredibly irritating. And it's not just their behavior, but it's also like the really broad Australian accent that Guy Pearce FX, which, I mean, I find Australian accents either very irritating or charming. It's one or the other. It's not usually both. Like, it's just one or the other. Uh-huh. And something about the way that Guy Pearce speaks in this role is just so annoying. Like, it's that's part of, it's not just his behavior, it's just his voice. It's just like, I want to scream.
And I'm he's also, he's quite catty and actually catty and insulting, which he's not nice.
He dead names, they wouldn't use that term at the time, but he dead names Bernadette by calling her Ralph constantly.
Yes. Yeah. And like,
which is, he likes getting a rise out of people, which I mean, that would have worked had the film done more to establish who he is as a character, so we understand mm-hmm. what's motivating this exactly. kind of bitchy behavior, but we don't get that, so it just comes across, at least for me, as being incredibly annoying.
Right, and so it's like, it's not as necessarily sanctioning, but it is like a, I didn't want him to get hate crime, but I do want him to be punished so that we can think about this, which I think is a very contemporary problem in our community. But this film obviously can't solve for everything.
Right.
But I was just like, ooh, you just slip right under the radar. You just get to continue being your hot, fucking mean self. And everyone's going to run around and think that that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, basically.
It's not like okay.
You hear that, himbos? It is not
Yeah, you okay. hear that? It is not okay.
Well, I have a feeling we might have both been projecting our deep ambivalence about thirst traps and himbos.
I'm going to go do some push-ups.
But I mean, but yeah, as I said, I think of the three characters, the main characters, that Felicia is by far the least developed. And mm-hmm. and I'm glad the film slowly edges away from her as it it seems to recognize as it goes on that it's actually Bernadette and to a lesser extent Tick that are more interesting, and so she becomes less enormously irritating as the movie goes on, mostly because she's just not as involved.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, let's be real though, I was thinking this to my partner when we were watching it, of the three of them, Guy Pearce actually looks more like what I would expect a real drag queen to look like when they're in drag. Like,
that's fair.
He actually looks like a drag queen. Like, yeah, he seems to embody that persona much more than the other two when they're in drag.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I have to say it. I'm sorry, but Felicia, I mean, there's a scene that's amazing and gorgeous. Like, they play opera. I don't remember which song it is, but I could tell you at the time because I'm a snob. But she has this, she's on top of the RV, they're speeding through the outback, and she has this flowing, just like beautiful piece of cloth that's almost like a cape behind her, and she's in full drag singing opera as it flows in the background. It's glamorous and beautiful, and I love it.
Must be that preparatory school upbringing, which you know she had.
Well, yeah, I guess. That's true. But yeah, it's very good. It's very good. So there's some redeeming qualities to her.
Yeah, she knows opera. So, well enough to lip sync it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would be remiss if we didn't also talk about another problematic character who admittedly is not in the film for very long, but that would be Bob's current wife, whose name I have to look up because I cannot remember right offhand. If she's, it's blah, 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 blah. Cynthia, who is Filipina and is the most vexing ethnic stereotype. Like, it's worth pointing out also that one of the groups that does accept the drag queens are the Aborigines. Like, they are the ones who, I believe,
they helped them out of the desert.
Yeah. So I hope that term's still PC. I actually don't know enough about Australian culture. I think they're still referred to as
Aboriginals. I think so.
Yeah. So they are actually very
the native accepting. People of Australia.
Yeah, are very accepting of the drag queens, which I think is important and juxtaposes them as opposed to, say, the white folk who are, you know, mostly awful. So I think that that's important. And they're not, and I didn't feel like they were tokenized, but I felt like they were at least given a sort of humanness and a warmth that, and that they are the ones who accept Bernadette at all.
Yeah. Well, the way that the film kind of portrays that is that each town they do a show, right?
Right.
And in every town, except for the ending town, everybody hates them pretty much.
Yeah.
And they laugh at them. But when the indigenous people find them and help them out, they do a show for them. And everybody's like clapping and they're getting into it. It's like, it's kind of like a drag show.
They start playing the didgeridoo and they start like incorporating into the performance.
So they kind of have like a moment in which like this is accepted. So I think the film definitely follows what you're saying.
Yeah.
But what else that was interesting, and I don't mean to change the subject, but they're like kind of bad at performing. The final show is not good at all.
Yeah, and I'm wondering to what extent that was just actors who don't know how to do drag.
That's what I'm like, okay, but are they supposed to be bad? Like,
I don't think so, but I also had I also had to wonder to what extent that is a product of just straight actors who don't know how to do drag very well.
Drag is not easy, there you go.
It is not easy. Yeah. But to return to Cynthia, at the time and since, it has been recognized as a pretty awful stereotype of the over-sexualized.
It's pretty bad.
And I mean, there's no getting around it. And I don't think that that ruins the whole film. I think the film still has many other redeeming qualities, but there's no sugarcoating that you know, because from everything about her, from her broken English to her hypersexualized attitude to shooting ping pong dolls out of her vagina, yeah. is gross. It's gross, yeah. and I'm sure it was gross at the time, and it still feels gross, and it feels gross because it's extraneous and seems to have no point.
Right. Is she is, yeah, the not even giving her a narrative is also a way in which it makes the movie very racist.
Yeah, but. And it's like, I mean, because I was reading up on it before the pod, and, you know, they were like, well, she's also an outcast in the world that doesn't, I'm like, that doesn't hold up.
I mean,
like,
that might also be true, but,
I mean, it's you know, true. That may be your intention, with, but yeah. but the strategy.
There are outcast narratives in this film, and she is not one of them.
Right. It's like she yeah. has no development except to speak broken English and to be basically emasculate, trying to emasculate Bob. And, like yeah. I said, to be an object of spectacle.
Yeah, and Bob isn't the greatest character. I mean, there's one thing, like, she clearly wants to be sexually free, and, like, part of her, the negativity toward her character is actually that she is sexually free, right? That right. Bob needs to, like, control her, because they're married to each other, and in some ways, like, his need to be, like, the man against her need to be, or her want to be, whatever, promiscuous, makes her into more of a stereotype, which is really unfortunate.
Yep. And I like I said, I've found that gross even.
Yeah.
That's one thing it's impossible for, and I would not have any desire to try to redeem.
Yeah.
But other than that, I do think that the film is a surprisingly sensitive film, much more so than I would have expected from a 94 movie. Like, I just, I thought that, you know, is it perfect? No. But I also think that, like, it gets things, I don't want to say gets things right, but I do, excuse me, that it is much more nuanced and rich and emotionally resonant than I would have, that, I mean, I've seen it, but I would have not have expected that from a film from this particular period and from Australia, yeah. which, you know, is not exactly the, I don't want to generalize, but it's culturally speaking, not always as accepting of queerness as we might expect.
Yes. I did hear a rumor that Australia was actually pretty homophobic.
Yeah. So, but overall, I think that I'm glad we chose this movie because I do think it is sort of one of the canonical movies in the
queer canon. Yeah, a good watch.
Okay, so now comes one of our most amusing and fun parts of the show, where we, Mark and I, take turns ribbing each other a little bit about our knowledge or lack thereof of queer culture, and sometimes, you know, culture more broadly, but certainly about queer, is called Are You Even Gay? And normally, certainly for the past few weeks, I've been the one harassing Mark, so now it's his turn to put me in the hot seat and to determine what I do not know about current culture.
Well, TJ, this isn't specifically gay, but I do have a story that kind of makes it a little gay. But, you know, as the younger of us here, as we know, I am closer.
My eyes are almost rolled back into my head.
I think I am a little closer to the youngins these days, and you know, I came across a term that frightened me. That I think I don't know. The Gen Zs have like come alive suddenly in my head, and now I'm obsessed with them a little bit. But I found out, so I'm going to ask you something, TJ, because this is definitely you, like to a C, I might say. Have you ever heard of the term chuggy?
No.
You don't know what chuggy means?
No.
Let me read you the definition of chuggy. It is used to describe someone or something that's outdated or trying too hard. Usually in a very millennial kind of way. This is from The Cut, by the way. And I have to say, TJ, you are such a chuggy.
So wait, is it a noun or an adjective?
I have no idea.
Is one a chuggy or is one chuggy? Because I think that makes a difference. So clearly you're not as familiar with this word as you think.
I mean,
you
I
are.
Am a chuggy too. I was called a chuggy last night. That's why I'm bringing it up. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And... because I apparently am such a chuggy, or like that is, I think it's both. Like, cause you can be like, that is so chuggy and you are a chuggy. It's like, okay, it's the okay boomer of the Gen Zers talking to us millennials.
Okay.
And you are such a chuggy.
There well, clearly is so are you. If some young person said it to you.
No, not a young person. No, a young person didn't say it to me. My friend said it to me, but I will tell you something funny. So I'm not on the TikTok, but my boyfriend is on the TikTok, and he was talking to me the other day about apparently the Gen Zers are on TikTok being like, oh yeah, they say, instead of saying music by ABBA, they say music from Mamma Mia. And he was like, oh my god, I'm so old that, like, they think that music from back then, they don't even know where it's from. And I was like, yes, you're too old. You need to get off TikTok. Like, TikTok is not for us.
Like, you're right. It is not for us.
Yeah, it is not for us. We're too chuggy.
I have a friend who's like 40 and she still gets on TikTok and does shit. And I'm like, why? Like,
I mean, we should be on TikTok.
Maybe,
but
maybe she is chuggy.
She's chuggy. You're chuggy. Yeah. I just don't understand, like, what is being a millennial? Like, what does that even mean? What is that? So, how am I being chuggy?
I don't understand where it derives from. Like, I understand, like, where bougie comes from. Like, so it's like, is it a derivative of some existing word? Like, or is it just something they made up of whole cloth? Like, I have so many questions.
I could read the rest of the cut article if you want.
It's apparently, it has its Wikipedia entries, so. Oh, okay.
Apparently, very chuggy to even ask what chuggy means.
Well, apparently, from what I'm reading, it was coined in 2013.
2013? Oh my god, I'm so old.
But apparently it came out, it's become popularized in 2021.
Okay. Yeah, Jesus so you're Christ. Very chuggy because you're such a millennial.
Excuse me, you are far more of a millennial than I am. I'm like,
what if do you mean? I'm at the tail end. I'm almost Gen Z. I'm so youthful.
Honey, you are literally the definition of a millennial. Like, you were born in 94 and came of age in 2000.
I was
like,
born in
6.
93.
So you were literally what are you talking about? The tail end. Like, what are
am
you
I
talking
millennial?
About?
When does millennial end?
You're like right smack in the middle of millennial. Okay.
I don't know why I thought I was.
No, weird. you're a textbook millennial.
Shut up. Textbook chuggy. Also, did you know that they apparently, like, I just don't understand why they're coming for us. Like, we haven't even done anything. I haven't done anything. I'm only 27. How am I already, like, a boomer? I don't understand. I didn't even do anything.
Welcome to being in your late 20s, darling.
I guess. I'm barely in my late 20s. I'm about to be really in my late 20s. But, they also apparently they have fake signs that they use on their TikToks that millennials think is one thing, but they know is actually another thing. And I'm like, why are you guys making up secret languages to, like, screw with us? What have we done? We don't have any power. I'm not doing anything. It's like weird code name shit. I don't know. It's very weird. Anyway, yeah. I have to ask you, TJ, because you didn't know what chuggy meant. Are you even gay?
Well, I have two things to say. One, I could just as easily ask you since you didn't know what it was until recently.
Yeah, but I know that now.
and secondly, yes, I'm fucking gay. Mm-hmm.
You're gay. We're gay elders now. Oh my god!
I was gay before you even born, Mark.
Whatever.
True story.
It is a true story. Yeah. Whatever. It's all I got for you. I don't understand the youth these days.
You have kids these days.
Whatever. Guess I'll be an
kids
elder
these days. Yeah.
I didn't know I'd be a gay elder before 30.
Yeah. Well, welcome to 2021, my friend.
Fine. Anyway, bye.
Bye. Well, thank you all for joining us for another fantabulous episode of Queens of the Bees. We, as always, we do want to express our sincerest gratitude to all of our regular listeners who have been kind enough to, you know, leave us some ratings on Apple and just tuning in every week and downloading our podcast. Mm-hmm. That really means a lot. I mean, it goes without saying, perhaps, but we just feel it's important that we acknowledge that we wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for all of you. And we really, really appreciate all of your support, both, as I said, in terms of downloads and ratings, but also just in terms of just being there and reaching out to us. But we would also reiterate that if you could give us a rating on Apple, every rating definitely helps build our visibility. And that's really important for little podcasts like ours that don't have the huge following just yet.
Yes. Rate us on Apple Podcasts, please.
And everywhere else.
Tell your friends.
Yeah, tell your friends. You know, we're not just for the queers. I mean, that's obviously our primary audience, but we also love the straights,
I won't,
too.
Yeah.
The normies. So, Mark, why don't you tell us where we can find you on social media?
You can find me on Instagram at MusterTheCourage and on Twitter at MusterTheCourage without the E. And TJ, where can people find you?
You could find me on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. So just TJ West 3. On Instagram at Thomas West 3. And then you can also look at our blog, our Medium public on Medium, which is also titled Queens of the Bees. If you just go, you know, type in Queens of the Bees Medium, it'll take you right there. It will have some write-ups of the films we've talked about, but we also talk about a lot of other queer culture issues. We definitely invite all of you to you know, see what else we're chatting up about on in the written world. And also don't forget that you can also donate to our podcast. We don't mind doing this for free, but a little bit of money wouldn't hurt either. So if you want to click on the donate button, you can find it through our Buzzsprout website. Each episode has the little donate button.
Yeah, and as always, Eric Cervini, if you're listening, we would love to have you on the pod.
We would indeed.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Bye, all. Bip, bip.